Okay, so let's continue the subject we spoke about yesterday. One of the most important subjects. The idea of respecting authority. So we said that basically there are three types of opinions, and we define them as any opinion that you hear that an authority decides upon. So you have to make the decision whether the opinion is right, wrong but reasonable, or wrong but unreasonable. Wrong and unreasonable, right? So there are three types, right? So if it's right, you follow it, right? If it's wrong but reasonable, you follow it in public, right? And according to many opinions, in the privacy of your own home, when nobody sees you, you can follow. You have the right to follow what you think, what you are absolutely sure that is right, even though the whole world is saying it's wrong. If you are absolutely convinced, right, something that is in your mind beyond any doubt. Remember, I gave you the example of the man who slaughters the animal, and he has absolutely no doubt that it's kosher or unkosher, and the rest of the world is saying otherwise. So many authorities believe that you should follow your own opinion against the whole world, but it's only in private. And in public, you have the obligation to respect the opinion of the authority. And when if it comes to an opinion which is wrong and unreasonable, right, then not only don't you have to listen to it, but you're either even allowed to rebel against the authority. And this is the rationale behind the rebellions that we do find in Jewish history. We mentioned yesterday one of the famous rebellions, the rebellion against Rabban Gamliel, if you remember, right? If the idea of authority would be in any case you can't rebel against authority, then rebellions wouldn't be possible in Judaism. The fact that we do find the possibility of a rebellion, that means that there is such a thing as an opinion which is unreasonable that I can fight against. And I have no obligation to respect authority. The same thing really gives an answer to another problem. You know that when the Jews split up, you know, the civil war by the Jewish people, when the 10 tribes went against the 2 tribes after the death of Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. After the death of King Solomon, do you know who was supposed to be king of the whole of Israel? The son of King Solomon, Rehavam. He was supposed to be the king of all the Jewish people. As a matter of fact, nobody doubted that King David was given kingdom forever for all his descendants. Nobody had any doubt on this point. And still, once Shlomo HaMelech dies and his son takes over, right, there is a rebellion. And Jeroboam, right, secedes and he separates himself from the 2 tribes. Benjamin and Judah stay together in the south. And all the northern part of Israel become a separate state with a separate king, separate government. Right. Now, we know that this man Jeroboam, he was a good Jew in a very high level. Very high level. As a matter of fact, we have hints in the Bible itself, but in the Talmud, we actually find that he was a very, very special person, Jeroboam. So how can it be that a Jew, right, who is loyal to the Torah should rebel against something which is clear in the Torah, that it's correct? Right? The son of Shlomo HaMelech is supposed to be king. The answer is because he made certain decisions, Rehavam, the king of Israel, the king of Judah, which he felt were wrong and unreasonable. Now, the Bible even tells you this story. He was advised, Rehavam, right, to lower taxes. It's interesting. Taxes was a major issue. To lower taxes. The burden of taxing can only go along with a certain pride in the kingdom, which after the death of Shlomo HaMelech, people didn't have anymore. And he had to face the fact, he's no Shlomo HaMelech. Right? So, if you're a Shlomo HaMelech, if you're a King Solomon, you can afford to, you know, just burden people with taxes, and people won't rebel because they feel that they got something out of it. Shlomo HaMelech, right? The pride of being led by Shlomo HaMelech. But as soon as his son became king, he was advised by the mature advisors, you know, you can't lead the people like your father Shlomo did. He took the advice of younger advisors, if you remember this story, and he said, what? No, you have to show, you know, the strength of the government from the beginning. If you don't show the strength, the whole thing will fall apart. This was deemed unreasonable, not only wrong, but unreasonably wrong. And therefore, it allows the people in Israel to rebel. This was the rationale for rebellion. Otherwise, what other rationale can there be? So again, what do we see from here? That if a person reaches the point that he's convinced that the opinion of the authority not only is wrong, but unreasonable, without any basis in reason, you have the right to rebel.
The authority,
because here there is really no difference. It can be the Sanhedrin also. Let's say... Oh, good, good, very good, very good, very good. We're going to come to it right away, right away. So, but here the rule, right? The king makes a decision. The king makes a decision, and that's the decision that the Torah says he should follow, right? Because the king is an institution that is created by the Torah, and you have to listen to the king. But if I feel that the king is wrong and unreasonable, I don't have to listen to him, right? Yeah.
I just finished recently going through Kings, and I had a very hard time from what I read. Going through the king, seeing these people actually thought of it in a Talmudic sense, that I went through this three stages and I got to the stage where this person is unreasonable before I may rebel. Because, and also Rehoboam, you're saying he was a good Jew, but he instituted idol worship in that part of the country.
In the kingdom of Israel. You are right. You mean eventually did he become corrupt? Sure, because power corrupts. What did he see? Once he became king of Israel, once he became king of the northern kingdom, he realized that he's going to lose it. Because Jews were attracted to the Beis Hamikdash, to the temple. And he felt that as long as Jews are attracted to the temple, and in which area was the temple? In the southern part. He is losing the centrality of the power because people are going to gravitate towards Judah, to the southern part. So he figured that in order to maintain what he thought was right, you have to create an alternative religion too.
Alright, what about the other kings that came after him? The whole lineage of the kings of Israel, there was one coup d'etat after another.
Exactly. Where does that come from?
Because they felt the other one was
wrong and unreasonable, because otherwise you can't rebel against the king. Alright. So here we have the following question. But the Torah says clearly, or the Torah seems to be saying, that you must follow the authority of the legislative body, whether they are right or they are wrong. Right? How? Because it says the following way. Follow the opinion of the rabbis. That's what it says. Right? Don't turn right or left from what they tell you, says the oral tradition. What is the idea of don't turn right or left? Says the oral tradition. That means even if they tell you it's right, and you know that it's left, or they tell you it's left and you know it's right, listen to them. So what does that seem to imply?
It's a reason we're supposed to
do. Right, that no matter what, right? So if so, we have many, many questions on that. The commentaries say we have many, many questions. Because it says clearly that if a Sanhedrin, if a court of law, will make a decision, for instance, that idol worship is permitted. That's what they'll decide. Should you listen to them or shouldn't you listen to them? More. If you listen to them, do you have a justification afterwards, but they told me so? No. Why? Because it's too obvious. So isn't there a contradiction to right and left? So I once saw a beautiful, beautiful insight into the idea of right and left. How come this is chosen? The idea of being wrong as making a mistake between right and left. The point is like this, you see. If I come towards you, let's say you are the rabbi and I'm the pupil, right? And I come towards you and I ask you, where is the right side? So you'll tell me, here, right? I'm coming towards you. Think about it, right? I'm coming towards you, and I ask you, which is the right side? You tell me, here. So I think to myself, no, that's wrong. It's the left side. Because you are facing him, you see. You didn't put yourself in his shoes. So therefore you are lacking an insight. So he tells you, no. Those things come from the fact that you are not in his position, so you don't really see the truth. Do you hear the symbolism of right and left? So therefore, if you would be in his position, you would know the truth. So therefore the Torah chooses the example of right and left, because the Torah wants to point out something that you say, listen, after all, I'm only a disciple and he's the teacher. I have to give him the benefit of the doubt. So that implies that that is only something when there is room for doubt. But what about if it's something if there is no room for doubt at all? It's a matter of, is today Thursday or Monday? And they say it's Monday. And I know beyond any reasonable doubt, meaning even if I put myself in his shoes, it's not Monday. That the Torah is not telling you to. Now, the Torah is choosing the point of right and left because it's something which leaves room for saying, listen, after all, my mind is limited. If I would be him, maybe I would say the same thing. In those things, I'm supposed to follow him. Okay? But not, I'm not supposed to follow blindly anything that a court says. And the proof is that if a court tells me to worship idols, I'm not allowed to do it. Not only that, I can't come to court afterwards and say, listen, how should I know better? They told me to worship the idol. Okay? So, again, what do we see? Again, the separation between something right, something wrong and reasonable, and something wrong and unreasonable. Now, everybody understands, of course, that there is a tremendous danger. There is a danger of chaos. If every person is his own judge, whether something is wrong and reasonable or wrong and unreasonable, right, then you are creating chaos. And the truth is, that's exactly what happened very often in Jewish history. As you know, if you read the Tanakh, those moments of chaos, of rebellions, come from the fact that many people mistook an opinion which was wrong and reasonable for wrong and unreasonable, and that they thought was a justification to act against it. That's the main problem. There's the main problem. It's one of the great sages of last century says that the problem during the Second Temple, that there was so much hatred. So he says like this, the reason was because people were only able to see right and wrong and nothing in between. What he means to say, either right or wrong and unreasonable. And anybody who differed with your opinion was seen to be a Sadducee, which means wrong and unreasonable. If we would be able to see the gray area, which means wrong and reasonable, they would not have been Sinat Chinam, and the temple would have not been destroyed. It's a shocking statement. That if we would have been able to see the middle ground, there would have been no destruction of the temple. Our problem was that we either said, either you are one of ours, or if not, you are one of the Sadducees, and the Sadducees are unreasonable, so therefore I can do anything I want against you. Right? So therefore, of course, I can do all the harm I want against you because you are a danger to society. All right? So, now, there are a few more details that I want to add concerning the obligation of respecting authority or the decisions of the kings or legislators. What about if there is a difference of opinion? Let me read the author, the author himself, which he brings down this particular point. What about if there is a machloket bein hachachamim? I live in a generation, and there is a difference of opinion among sages. Sages which I trust are looking for the truth. Some say this way, and some say another way. Which way should I follow? So on the surface, why? Yeah, true. Who do you follow? So on the surface, you would say, well, shouldn't the law of majority apply? Right? So now, if it's a position which you deem unreasonable, wrong and unreasonable, then of course you don't have to follow anything. Right? So there's another very, very famous statement made by a great sage 200 years ago, Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz. He was once asked by a priest, it says in your Torah, follow the majority, right? The majority of people in the world, you know, are Gentiles, not Jews. Why don't you become a Gentile? Right? You have to be consistent with your own Torah. So you know, so the answer is exactly what I was telling you. He put it in a very sharply. He says, you only follow the majority when there is a doubt. When there is no doubt, you don't follow the majority, right? What does he mean to say? He means exactly what I was telling you. If it's a point of, it's right or wrong and reasonable, so I say, well, listen, I have to follow the majority. I must respect the majority. But what about if it's wrong and unreasonable? And that there is no road, there is no majority. That's what he was saying. In cases of clear-cut situations, I don't have to follow the majority. It's exactly what I was telling you.
How are you supposed to know what's unreasonable? There I understand, but how are you supposed to know all the time? You think it's unreasonable. Somebody else might say it is.
That's exactly what happened. That's why there are arguments among human beings. I say it's reasonable, and the other person says that it's terrible, it's unreasonable, it's crazy. That's why there are arguments among people. So, good, that's why we have problems. That's exactly the point. That's why there are arguments in the world, and that's why we have problems. We have even advice, the Torah gives us advice, how do you come to pure decisions, right? So what about if your powers of analysis just don't go any further and you say, I must make a decision. So the Torah says you have to clear yourself from any flaws, in other words, any ulterior motives. What are all the possible ulterior motives that a person can have? That says the Mishnah. Either jealousy, lust, or the drive for power. That's one of the three. If you are able to overcome the three weaknesses, any opinion that you're going to come to will be a true opinion. Yeah? So the point is that it's not enough to be very intelligent and analyze the position clearly. That's not enough. You can be a genius and you won't be able to make the right decision. In order to make the right decision, you have to work on yourself. You have to purify your own ulterior motives, your own flaws, and then your decision will be the right one, okay? So, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's what creates problems in the world. Now, so, shouldn't we say that if we live in an era when there are arguments among sages, right, that I should follow the advice of the Torah, if the opinion is either right or wrong and reasonable because I heard it and it makes sense? But I don't know, should I follow it or not? Right. And I can't come to a decision myself. So shouldn't I follow the law of majority? I should go around counting how many sages say one way and how many sages say the other way. Okay? So this what is the subject of what he's going to be talking about right now. So he says the following. Ubechirat rovze. This advice that the Torah gives you, follow the majority, right? If there are no other means of decision making, follow the majority. Hu keshishnei kitot acholkot yodot bechokhmat haTorah b'shaveh. When they are both qualitatively speaking equal. When they are qualitatively speaking equal, then you can say that quantity is the deciding factor. But what about if qualitatively they are not equal? Then you must ignore the quantitative difference. Which means, if they come to a court of law and the court of law decides, then you follow the law majority and you don't look at the quality. Because once the court decides, the court decides. But if they didn't get together, it's just a matter of some sages saying one way and some sages saying another way, you can only rely on the law of majority if you are sure that qualitatively speaking they are equal. But if not, one qualitative opinion is superior to 100 lesser qualified opinions. So therefore, there goes the law of majority. And of course, he comes, you know, the problem comes back. Who do I rely on? Okay? So I have to rely on someone who is qualitatively speaking superior to the others. Right? But there's a big problem. What about if I'm not qualified, right, to make the decision? So, I can't rely on majority, so I have to rely on superiority. But I am not a judge of superiority, so who can I rely on? So there is a very, very nice insight given by one of the commentaries. A person is constantly making decisions in matters that he has no insight in, all the time. Right? You make a decision. You are establishing your future. Should I become an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer? Right. So how do I know? Do I know? I mean, did I go through it? So I hear one opinion, and one says one way, then the other opinion, it says the other way. I need a medical opinion. What do I know about medicine? I know nothing about medicine. So I ask one person, he says one thing. I ask the other doctor, he says something else. How do I make an opinion? How do I know which doctor to go to listen to this man or to not to listen to this man? How do I make a decision? Oh, so there is a whole system of choosing the right doctor or choosing the right career. And it's a very, very complex system that we don't know ourselves how we go about it, but we do intuitively go about it in a certain way. First of all, we ask people. And each person's opinion has a certain weight in our mind, right? I ask my neighbor, I ask my cousin, I ask my aunt, my uncle, right? I ask another doctor friend, and little by little that shapes the opinion. The more I rely on those opinions, the more, right, it shapes in me the belief that this doctor is right and the other doctor is wrong. And then comes my own opinion about the person. I met both doctors. One gives me a better feeling than the other. One seems to me, knowing nothing, seems to me more reliable than the other. I may be completely wrong. But all these factors will shape in my mind, right, a basis for an opinion which doctor to listen to, even though I know nothing about medicine. Now, is this the ideal way to make the decision? Of course not. The ideal way to make a decision which doctors to choose would be go to university for 10 years, right? Study medicine, right? And then you make a decision which doctor is right. That would be the ideal. The ideal would be that you should know everything in order to make an educated decision. But you can't wait. Therefore, you have to choose the second best. That's exactly the method that you must use for Torah decisions. If you can't know the differences in quality between the sages, you have to develop a system of decision-making the same way that you make a decision concerning which doctor to choose, or which career to follow, or which shoemaker to go to. It's all the same. It's all the same, except that a shoemaker is not that important because you don't care that much what happens to your shoes, but a doctor for sure is important, right? That's the same. That's the way you decide about which sage to follow. You create around yourself a system of decision-making, right? People that you rely, you have friends, you have teachers, right? You have neighbors who have different experiences. And then you put it all together in your mind and you weigh exactly the same way that you choose a doctor. It's a perfect analogy, this choosing a doctor and choosing who is right, right? Because it shows you the complexity of the decision-making and how crucial the process is. But you can't say there are so many more on one side than on the other, as he says. Because in this situation, when it's not a court, but it's just personal opinions of different sages, what counts is the quality and not the quantity. Okay? Now, there is another interesting fact which he brings out. This is in Mitzvah number 77. He says, when a court sits together, right? So let's say there are 71 members. Let's talk about the large court. The arguments, right? They present arguments. The arguments must start with the junior member of the court. It must never start with the senior member of the court. Why? On the surface, it should be the exact opposite. What would you say logically? Who should be the first one to present the arguments for or against the case? The senior member. So he says, no, that is not permitted. Why? Because, what's the logic behind it? Because immediately you become biased. If you hear somebody that you already have respect for saying his opinion, then your opinion is not your opinion anymore. It's affected by him. So therefore, if you start from the junior member, right, then it's his opinion, 100, and that's what we want. We want that there should be 71 opinions. Because if not, it would be 71 votes on one opinion, and then you don't have 71 opinions, and you need 71 opinions.
But then I was thinking exactly the opposite. What happens is that the last one is when you end up confirming the last opinion you hear. I would say the last opinion is the more one carries.
Definitely. But who will be affected by it? Somebody who is superior. The nature of the superior one, right, there is a rank in the court. junior, the superior one will be much less affected. Because he feels, listen, you know, I can hear his case, and that you are obligated to do, to hear the other person's opinion. But it won't have the weight to overweigh your real decision of right and wrong. But if it's the other way around, you say, in the back of your mind, after all, you know, who am I, you know. So you wouldn't say your real opinion, okay? And what we want is 71 independent opinions. Now, let's talk a little bit about the formation of the courts. How were they chosen? You know that according to our tradition, the Sanhedrin, the large Sanhedrin, the high court, was established during the lifetime of Moshe Rabbeinu, while Moshe was still alive, right, in the desert. And they were chosen through divine signs, right, 70 members plus Moshe Rabbeinu, altogether 71. And those people, right, were called musmachim. Musmach, the word musmach means people who had the hands put upon them, lismoch. And that this is why a rabbinical degree today, you know what it's called? Smicha, because it's borrowing that term, which means because that's how they used to do it. Putting the hands on top of the heads, it's like giving him over the right to be a judge. But unfortunately, a few thousand years ago, the system stopped. Right? And we have no more musmachim. So real judges, we don't have anymore. So if we would want to establish a Sanhedrin today, we couldn't. We don't have musmachim. Real musmachim. What we do today is something that looks like the real smicha, but it isn't. You know, a rabbinical degree today is not the original smicha. But the original system was that each judge has the right to appoint another judge. Now, they would sit in the Sanhedrin, and the system was the following. There were 71 members. They sat in the order of seniority, right? The number one here, the next one, number two, number three, number 71. And then it continues. Number 72, number 73, and so on and so on and so on. It could come to 100. Of course, voting rights, only the first 71 hit. But let's say at a certain moment, when it comes to a vote, one of them would say, you know what, I don't have an opinion. I can't make my decision. Eini yodea, I don't know. Immediately, his vote would be void, and then the number 72 would become the voter, and so on, the number 73, because saying I don't know is not an opinion, and you need 71 opinions. Okay, now the moment one of them dies, automatically number 72 becomes 71. So in such a way there was a continuity in the courts, right? And that went on for thousands of years. Unfortunately, during the Second Temple, during this period of the Second Temple, after all, the government wasn't in our hands ultimately. It was in the Roman hands. So they started putting in the courts their people. Right? And people used to buy positions in the court. So at a certain point, the heads of the Sanhedrin decided they couldn't completely throw them out. Right? They would be punished by the government. So they decided that from now on we don't vote anymore. We decide by consensus. And if there isn't, we'll have to split the opinion and say that one rabbi holds one way and another rabbi holds another way. And this is the beginning of the two schools in Israel, something that never happened in Israel. There couldn't be two schools of Torah. Why? Because as soon as there is a difference of opinion, it comes to the court and it's decided by a majority. But since at that point, they didn't want to rely on a majority because they knew that many members of the court weren't worthy. It was both positions. So therefore, they decided that if they can come to a consensus, okay, and if not, all the Jewish people will know that the school of Shammai says one thing and the school of Hillel says another thing. If you want to follow the school of Shammai, then do this. You want to follow the school of Hillel, do this.
Within the school of Shammai, Hillel was an interesting thing of what sees.
There were what?
What, see,
no. No, not in the school. Shammai and Hillel were both members of the Sanhedrin.
Right.
But within the Sanhedrin, there were people that were put in there by the government. So therefore, they couldn't say, let's come and vote, and whoever wins, wins. In other words, I'm just giving you an explanation why is it at a certain point there was a split by the Jewish people that there were two schools of Torah decisions. How could it be? Right? The reason why it existed is because they couldn't vote. They weren't, the heads of the Sanhedrin didn't allow the vote because they knew that it's an invalid vote. So this is where the split of Klal Yisrael. Right? So we are saying decisions that weren't clarified in the lower courts. It can be a decision about something kosher and not kosher. Right? It can be a matter of what blessing to say on food. Anything which wasn't decided to the lower courts, they would come to the higher courts. And if there was a consensus in the higher court, fine, that was the decision. Everybody says the same thing. Then there is no problem.
Everybody.
That was all the members of the Sanhedrin say the same thing. There's no problem. But what about if there is a split? Right? They did not allow a vote. So then they had to announce, if you belong to my school, do this. If you belong to his school, do this. And that was the beginning of the end of the unity of Torah by the Jewish people. Right? Because the whole idea of the Sanhedrin was to unify the Torah. That it shouldn't come out that each person has his own Torah. We couldn't avoid it anymore. And from that point on, that's what happened by Klal Yisrael. There was a school of Shammai and school of Hillel, right? And never the twain shall meet. It was a major, major problem, right? People would avoid eating by each other because, in certain situations, because of differences of opinion, right? There were, according to some commentators, they would avoid marrying each other because of certain problems, unless they wouldn't lie to each other. They would tell them the truth. Listen, I think you are not allowed to marry my daughter because according to you, are the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel. All right. According to us, this is what caused the Sinat Chinam. The Sinat Chinam, the hatred, right, came about because of the split among the Jewish people. If the split wouldn't have happened, then the Sadducees would have never developed. You know, the Sadducees was a major reason for the split by the Jewish people. The reason why the Sadducees could create their own opinion is because there was no decision making in the Sanhedrin. So if there is a school of Shammai and Hillel, why can't I start my own school of Sadducees? At that point, everything is already open, right? Right. So therefore, we had to come on to telling people, listen, things which you are against, but it's reasonable, again, the same principle. Then respect it. Shammai respected Hillel, Hillel respected Shammai. But Hillel and Shammai disrespected because they felt it was an unreasonable wrong position, the position of the Sadducees. So they created already the split between wrong and reasonable and wrong and unreasonable. Hillel said about Shammai, you are wrong but reasonable. But the Sadducees, they are wrong and unreasonable. So therefore, you have to throw them out of Israel. They are not part of the Jewish people. Right? Yeah. Well, it was there. I mean, they took over the country, right? First it was the Greeks, and then the Romans, they took over.
But the Jews at the time were not negligent in Torah study when it comes to mitzvahs.
It's true. You're absolutely right. There was a problem with their inter-human relations. That was the flaw. Of course. We say that the split was just a reflection of a flaw that was developing in them. The event itself reflects a flaw that was already taking roots in the nature of the Jewish people. And that's why we suffer, right? That's why we suffer up to this day. Okay, we'll stop here.